We go.
Na 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 sword.
This is Pure Decking number 224 for Thursday, June the 23rd, 2016. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like our current police state information security and the fact that tomorrow morning for breakfast, I am making waffles. And it will be glorious.
Blueberry waffles?
No, just regular waffles.
Less glorious, my friend. Less glorious.
No waffles. I disagree.
Well, that just means that you're wrong. Sorry. I have to inform you of that on your own show.
I disagree. That and the fact that I didn't feel like buying blueberries. Anyways, I am Morps. I am drinking Newcastle Ale. Tonight I have Madman. Madman, what are you drinking? And what glorious breakfast will you be having tomorrow?
Leinenkugel's IPL. And probably sausage and biscuits. Maybe hash browns if I want to actually work it.
Excellent, glorious breakfast. Outstanding. BSV, what are you drinking, and what glorious breakfast will you be having tomorrow?
I actually came prepared. I got a jug of Granite City 2-pole.
Nice.
And breakfast, unfortunately, before work, it's normally whatever I can quickly hobble together, so...
That will not be a glorious breakfast.
No. But in the meantime, I still have alcohol.
If it's King Vitamin, you at least have a mask you can pop out of the back of the box when you're done.
No, but it comes in a nice glass jug I can smack somebody over the head with if they disagree with me.
Beer, the liquid cereal of champion.
I guess it kind of is, actually. I wouldn't have thought about it that way.
Hey, you can take a box of grape nuts and turn it into beer just by adding water and yeast.
I don't
may take a while.
I don't think it'd be a very good beer, but...
Never said it would. Just saying. It has the other ingredients in it.
What are you doing with all them grape nuts and a mortar and pestle? I'm really thirsty. Or what's the oat bran or whatever it is? God. Beer made from breakfast cereal. I want to know what Captain Crunch beer tastes like.
I think I have a pot big enough I can start trying to
So are we gonna be starting our own brand of breakfast beers then? Or?
I don't know. You think we'd get sued by like Post and... I forget the other cereal company. There's like two of them.
Kellogg's.
You can't do that. Why not? I thought the cartoon characters would look fantastic on the label.
Smashed. Out of their minds. Their pants down. Pissing into a dumpster. Oh, I've got the label right in my mind. No one will ever look at Tony the Tiger the same again.
I'm pretty sure they don't already after the series of commercials depicting him as a pedophile.
Horrible people breaking my childhood.
Dude, seriously, they had all these commercials where he's like hanging around a small child and the parents are around and don't really seem to notice, and it's like you're not really certain if he's supposed to be there or not.
I just assumed the child was schizophrenic and it was a hallucination of a giant talking tiger wanting him to eat breakfast cereal.
Yeah, but Calvin and Hobbes was actually good as opposed to... Anyways, first discussion, or the discussion story for tonight. It's on Ars Technica. I guess I can just start reading here. In New Mexico, there's a convicted murderer serving a life sentence. He won a new trial because the DNA prosecution expert in the case testified via Skype. And the court has determined that he is that denied the defendant his Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses in court, according to the New Mexico Supreme Court.
Hold up. They could ask questions over Skype.
Yeah.
Well, but I think the exact phrasing of the amendment is to face your accuser.
They could pull up a video chat.
And technically he's not the accuser? The accuser would be the state?
So, let me read some of the story here for you. The case against Thomas began in 2010 when the Albuquerque police discovered Guadalupe Ashford's body behind a trash can in a small parking lot. Dude, you put it on a park bench posed. We all know this. Like, you know, face down to hide the hole. It's just...
Put a beer in the hand that's fallen over the bench so it looks like they passed out.
They'll be there for like a week before anybody even thinks to poke the body. I mean, before anybody thinks we're making that shit up, that happened in New York. The body was really there for like 3 days before anybody.
And it wasn't 3 days of no one saying it. They just didn't want to disturb the homeless guy passed out on the bench.
And they think it's a homeless guy, so they expect them to smell bad.
The woman was assaulted and sustained significant head injuries. Okay, I really shouldn't be making light of this woman being murdered, but I've been on vacation, so I'm going to be making light of things. The woman was assaulted and sustained significant head injuries, including lacerations, skull fractures, and a dislodged tooth. Police found blood on the scene that did not match the woman's and ran it through the combined DNA index system database, which matched the defendant. The defendant denied he knew the woman. More than 2 years after his arrest, he went to trial. Good God, 2 years before he went to trial?
That might not have been the prosecution stalling. That could have been the defense attorney stalling.
Well, I know, but I'm pretty sure you have a right to a speedy trial. I don't think we're using that word correctly.
And if you're the defense attorney stalling, you're giving up your right to a speedy trial. It's not the prosecution stalling. That's why you have to point that out and find out which one it is before you judge.
Because if the prosecutor's ready to go, speedy trial is whatever.
Yeah,
it must suck to spend 2 years sitting in jail waiting to go to trial. Doubt they're letting him out on probation.
Oh, no. Oh, wait a minute. You can actually get probation on murder. Not always denied.
Anyways, but the state's forensic analyst who had originally tested the blood found that the crime scene had moved, moved away from New Mexico. The defense attorney initially said there was no problem with two-way Skyping of the expert at the trial, but then altered course as the trial approached. Prosecutors did not subpoena the expert to appear based on the defense counsel's initial statement that Skype would work, and the judge allowed it to happen. A local jury subsequently convicted the defendant of murder and kidnapping. The New York Supreme Court tossed the kidnapping charges, saying the evidence didn't support the charge. The state's top court reserved the murder conviction because of the Skype testimony and ordered a new trial. The unanimous New Mexico Supreme Court ruled the expert witness who testified via Skype was the only APD forensic scientist analyst who had actually performed measurements of the DNA samples in the case. Her involvement in the case was significant, and she testified to the results of the measurement she performed. The DNA profiles were offered as sole evidence that implicated the defendant in this crime. We conclude that there is no reasonable possibility the testimony of the absent forensic analyst did not influence the verdict, and accordingly that error was not harmless. So it was like, this is the key witness, right? This is the DNA evidence is why they convicted this person of murder, and that person testified via Skype. It's just, it's kind of interesting to me that initially the defense said, oh yeah, it's fine, and then, you know, turned around and said, no.
How far before trial did this happen?
I would assume sometime within the 2 years, because they don't say. The court noted its Friday ruling that the U.S. Supreme Court said in the Confrontation Clause in the Constitution was not absolute and had ruled in 1990 that a child abuse victim could testify over one-way closed-circuit television while physically located in a room separate from the judge, the jury, and the defendant who could hear and see the testimony. The nation's top court found that the lack of face-to-face confrontation was okay when necessary to further an important public policy and only where the reliability of the testimony is otherwise assured. In 2004, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the testimony from an absentee witness can only be admitted if the person is unavailable and where the defendant has had a prior opportunity to cross-examine. Oh, they didn't get to cross-examine the forensics analyst over Skype.
They were on Skype. What was preventing them from asking the question? It's Skype. I've used Skype.
Skype is not a one-way system.
What's more, the tape state's top court said the U.S. Supreme Court in 2002 rejected a proposal to amend the federal rules to allow unavailable witnesses to testify via two-way video, the court noted. The New Mexico top court said a retrial on the murder charge does not amount to double jeopardy because there was sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction, despite the Sixth Amendment violation. The defendant argues that the jury verdict was inherently speculative because the DNA evidence did not adequately prove that the defender was the killer and because some hallmarks of the defendant or of the deliberate intent, such as a motive or careful planning, were missing. There was sufficient evidence to allow for a trier of fact. I don't know that word. Allow a trier of fact to reasonably infer the defendant who killed Ashford. Physical evidence containing a full DNA profile matching the defendant was found on Ashford's body in semen on her thigh and under the fingernails of her right hand, and also on the paper stone presumed to be the murder weapon. Damn, that's dark.
Oh.
Rape a chick and beat her over the head with a paving stone. I mean, that's
the that's damn near Muslim of him. You can mark it in the time.
The jury was informed that the unidentified DNA was also present and was alerted in closing arguments to consider the possibility that another person or people could have been involved. So there's other things going on with this trial, right? There's questions about the conviction, because it appears that this guy was only convicted on DNA evidence. But the fact that the person who did the forensics work testified over Skype is interesting. So there's a lot of details missing here. For example, I would think if you were going to testify over Skype, you know, even though it's Skype, you wouldn't be doing it from your living room. You would probably still have to go to a courtroom wherever you are and set up the video conference, right?
Yeah.
That way you could be properly sworn in. You're in a controlled environment.
When it comes to swearing in, they can have a court official go to where you are. They do that in hospital rooms and other places where the witness or the defendant can't move.
I mean, it seems like – so it seems to me like it's a technicality that they may not have properly set up this remote witness. And claiming they didn't get to cross-examine, I think is also weird, because you're right, it's Skype. It's not like you can't talk back.
Yeah, I was thinking when we first read the headlines that the reason they're saying they didn't get to confront the witness is the witness wasn't in the room. But if it's over Skype, you can cross-examine the witness and ask them whatever questions you want. And all of the remote testimonies I know of, there's a court official with the person testifying. So
yeah,
it's not,
I mean,
like where we hop on TeamSpeak from all over the country and we're alone in rooms, whatever. This, there'd be a court official there.
Yeah, I mean, and this is a forensic scientist. This is, you know, somebody who's worked with the police in the past. Obviously, they know the procedure. They probably could have done it from where they're currently working and had somebody act as an officer of the court. I mean, it seems like that's a technicality that could have been worked around, and the fact that the defense initially said it's fine and then changed their mind is interesting.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot more going on here.
Defense had no questions.
Well, if they had no questions, doesn't that give up the cross examination?
Yeah. I mean, don't ask is a funny thing in the chat room. Did they just forget to push the talk key when the defense is asking questions?
How do you... Which button is the push to talk?
Oh, sorry. He was muted the entire time. Oh, well, time's up. I mean, but, like, well, we had to end the call.
at least it sounds like they're retrying it, so...
Yeah, they're going to retry it.
With that
it.
Much DNA evidence, this... I doubt the person's...
And this time the lab tech gets an all-expense-paid trip to the glorious state of New Mexico.
Along
with a great spider migration.
I don't want to know what's going on in New Mexico with spiders.
Oh, dude. Every so often, every tarantula in the desert decides to go somewhere. I have no idea where they're going, but it looks like a carpet is moving if you look outside during the giant the great spider migrations.
Remind me never to go to New Mexico.
I've been to Arizona.
I never saw that.
Be pretty cool.
I'd like to be out there with like a flamethrower. I think that'd be fun.
Has anybody seen Fluffy?
All the screaming dead spiders.
Oh, that's right, tarantulas can actually scream.
Yeah. So,
I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, you would think in this day and age, because I've been to courtrooms multiple times, and you know, even several years ago, they're set up with projectors and microphones and, you know, moderately modern IT setups. So hooking a laptop up and doing a Skype and patching in a decent, you know, speaker and microphone rig so that, you know, the court could operate doesn't seem like it'd be that outlandish. Just as long as they're on the other end, you know, they have an officer of the court present, or maybe they're at a local courthouse so that they can have... I don't know. Maybe it doesn't work across state lines. Maybe you can't have officers for the court of one state, you know, assist another state. I don't... Maybe I'm missing something there.
You can be licensed in multiple states.
Well, no, I realize that. I'm just... I mean...
The court
if you
officials.
Have a... Yeah, I mean, if you have a prosecuting office in one office, and can they not ask for assistance across state lines to allow somebody to Skype so that you can have an officer of the court present? I mean...
Yeah, and the court systems still do have reciprocity across state lines, even if they don't have jurisdiction.
I mean, surely the judge should just declare somebody over there, clerk or something, as, you know, assisting in this case, and... Okay, you go into this room, here's our video conference setup. I mean, hell, you don't have to use Skype. You could get a little bit of infrastructure in there, and I've played with some of Cisco's teleconferencing stuff. It's pricey for what it is, but it works.
Last time I was in a courtroom, we were doing teleconferencing. I wasn't teleconferencing. The defendants accused of assault and drug trafficking were doing the teleconferencing in, but they weren't actually there. It was a TV in front of the judge.
Yeah, I guess I don't see the problem with that. I mean, yeah. If as long as it's a two-way communication and you know, both sides get to ask their questions, if it's a witness, I don't see a problem with it.
No, you're getting to confront your accuser, which is what it says.
I guess if it's Skype with one of those crappy webcams where they're using the Instagram filters and they start giving the person googly eyes or you know, like the newspaper filter or whatever the hell it is, or you know, some of the other stupid bullshit they can do with webcams and chat programs, that would probably be distracting, but.
Oh, I can even see that as not a confronting your accuser. You've masked him at that point.
So, I don't know. I guess I don't see the problem with it with appropriate management.
And so long as the defense gets to question them, they're fine.
So, You know, unless, of course, it's some, you know, it's like, what's the defendant from jail? Well, that's probably a bad visual. So, I mean, and, you know, back to the case they were talking about, he was already in the defendant DNA system, or whatever it was. Yeah, he was already in a DNA database, so there's that.
That means he's been suspected or convicted before. Not that that can be used in his current trial or anything.
Well, you know, I'm just saying. I mean, I don't. You know, they're saying it was the dude's DNA there. Although, you know, we had the article a couple of weeks ago about how these DNA tests are accurate to like 1 in 1,000, as opposed to, you know, directly identifying
somebody. 1 in 1,000 is kind of terrible.
Yeah, they're pretty bad.
If it's 1 in 1,000. That means there's at least 360 people for everyone that's matched up. I'm thinking that right. There's 360 million people in the U.S. So one in a thousand.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose if you get DNA samples from one person, you know, if you were comparing, you know, sample to sample, you'd probably get a, you know, fairly accurate match, but they're not doing that. They're comparing them to markers in a database. That's where the inaccuracy comes in, and that, you know, they're comparing this marker to that marker to that marker. So they're not doing the entire strand. They're doing chunks of it.
When I'm thinking DNA evidence, I'm thinking they did a DNA type for Bob, and the blood on whatever rock we think might have come from Bob. And there's a match. We're not doing segments here.
No.
You can pick a segment of Bob, and it's going to match a segment of every human on the planet, because Bob happens to be human.
No, dude, that's it does not work that way.
Oh, that is fucked up.
Oh, yeah, you got some reading to do, Madman. Yeah, DNA evidence isn't nearly as good as they make it out to be on TV.
Well, if they're only doing spot checks, yes. It's kind of crappy. You're narrowing it down to a human, depending on how small of a spot check you're doing.
We've confirmed this was not a gorilla that did this.
I mean, I share some DNA with oak trees. The strands for breaking down sugar, same in an oak tree as in a human. Small enough comparison, you can confuse the two.
So, here's a fun article. This one's from LegalMatch.com. How reliable are DNA tests? Exact probabilities of a match remain disputed. The FBI estimates the odds of a coincidental match are 1 in 108 trillion. Other estimates are 1 in 113 billion, or 1 in 10 billion, or 1 in 8,192.
8,192. That's multiple hits in a major city.
I love how it just goes, you know, they've got, it's so wildly, I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, you do some Googling on it. It's really interesting because you find articles with different matches and different numbers and you know, how accurate are these things, and we don't really know, and, you know, but yeah, they're not doing 100% matching to 100% matching, because it would, frankly, take too long. And, like you point out, large sections of it, if you're human, are going to be there, because you're human, but, you know, then, of course, you find the Stossels, who sent off things, and, like, sent dog hair off, and came back with a match, and... even sent off, like, doll hair and shit like that and came back with matches, so... It's,
Well, at least the doll hair, I can understand. Some dolls actually have real human hair.
I'd just be confused when they were synthetic hairs.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun reading to do on how accurate forensic science is with regard to DNA.
You'd think by now we would have improved the system a little bit?
Well, you know, one of the reasons we may not have is, one, it's in a very expensive system, two, it's way backed up. But yeah, there's like, I don't know, last time I heard a number was something like several thousand rape kits that are sitting there waiting because it's the system, there's not enough people doing the DNA processing. So there's not enough labs to do it quickly. But
and on yeah, some of those rape kits that are sitting there, it's because the person has decided not to press charges.
Well, there's that too. But I'm just saying there's a lot of those things, those kind of things floating around where it's not nearly as good as you think it is. Although, with the, you know, you would think with some of the improvements we've made in IT and databasing, it wouldn't be as bad as it is. But yeah, go do some reading on that if you want to.
Well, it might not be on the database end. It could literally be the chemical processing end.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know. So, but yeah, it apparently takes like months to get a DNA sample back from a lab in the first place. So, anyways, let's move on. Yeah, have some fun Googling that because there's all kinds of sources out there, and it's hard to know what's what. Next article, first news article up is from Ars Technica. Documents recently obtained by the conservative advocacy group Judicial Watch show that in December of 2010, then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her staff were having difficulty communicating with the State Department officials by email because spam filters were blocking their messages. This is the Clinton private server. The spam filters were blocking her domain. To fix the problem, I don't even have all the articles that were going on about how apparently they had disabled all kinds of security features to, you know, make it work.
You know, so, how you make it work? You follow the law and be like, "Hi, Secretary, you've just violated several national security protocols. I might have to shoot you in the face, or I can give you this .gov account that'll fucking work better with our system."
It gets better, Madman. To fix the problem, State Department IT turned the filters off.
They
didn't whitelist her domain. They didn't whitelist her server. They turned the filters off. And you know exactly what happened. Clinton was running the State Department. So she said, "I don't care. Just turn it off." She didn't understand what she was saying. She probably told somebody, or maybe it wasn't her directly. Maybe it was a higher up. But somebody said, "Don't care, turn it off, it's causing a problem." I know this because I've been on the receiving end of that conversation multiple times where somebody gets frustrated that you haven't got a filter working correctly or you know, a firewall rules in the way, and finally they just get mad and say, "Well, we've got people complaining, just turn it off."
And the number of Lebanese princes wanting your money just skyrocketed at the State Department.
Oh yeah,
you've won the Australian lottery a few hundred billion fucking times.
Potentially exposing states' employees to phishing attacks and other malicious emails. The mail problems prompted Clinton Chief of Staff Hooman Abedin to suggest to Clinton, "We should talk about putting you on state email or releasing your email addresses to the department so that they are not going to spam." Clinton replied, "Let's get a separate address or device, but I don't want to risk any personal emails being accessible. Blah, 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 blah. Politics, politics, politics." Apparently, they were using Trend Micro Scan Mail for Exchange 8, was causing some messages from Clinton's private server not to be delivered. Some were bounced, others were accepted by the server, but were then quarantined and never delivered, which means people weren't checking their spam boxes. The one I run, you get a daily summary of what all's in your spam box, so you don't get to tell me you're not getting your spam. You just have to go through an extra loophole to get it.
I just want to double check to see what I heard right. The reason they were ordered to turn them off, because they didn't want the email address of her servers to be released to the department?
They did not want to tell her personal email addresses to State Department to add to the spam filters.
You just need the domain.
So you are absolutely correct. You can whitelist by domain. And, which means the state's IT team was probably just told to turn it off as opposed to fix it.
Would you like to know a reason for this BSV? Why she wouldn't want it?
That she didn't want them to know where her servers, about her servers?
Not quite. A Freedom of Information request is a request to a department or an individual for information. So if you're wanting information from the State Department, if you submit a Freedom of Information request, the State Department has to check their records and their archives, and any archives they know of that they may have submitted this information to. Like if you submit something to the State Department for a visa and they forward it to the Department of Defense, and the State Department knows it was forwarded to the Department of Defense and doesn't have a copy in its system anymore, it asks the Department of Defense for it. But if the State Department doesn't know who to ask for, then they can say they don't have it, and the information request dies there, because they have done everything they legally need to do to find the information. So if you think, let's say, the Secretary of State is doing something stupid, and you file a Freedom of Information request to get those documents, and then the State Department checks their known archives and their servers and don't have the information and didn't send it anywhere else and don't know where it could have been sent, they can say, "We don't have it." And they've complied with the Freedom of Information request. So by not providing that information to the State Department, he was able to get away with not providing Freedom of Information requests.
It gets even funnier because the rest of the article goes on to explain, according to email thread published yesterday by Judicial Watch, State's IT team turned off both spam and antivirus filters on two Bridgehead mail relay servers while waiting for a fix from Trend Micro. In other words... Okay, I need to explain for a second here, because I don't care who made your spam filter. You don't need a fix from the manufacturer to whitelist a domain or to whitelist email addresses, which means Madman's explanation is most likely the correct one. I run spam filters. I run email servers. Right now, as part of my job, I help to administer these things. Security audits on them every once in a while. Believe me, I actually know what I'm talking about on this one. You don't need a fix from the manufacturer to whitelist a domain. Don't. The fact that they're saying, "Oh, Trend Micro didn't give us a fix," means we're not accepting responsibility for our actions. And if that was, if somebody on my IT team came to me and said, "We can't whitelist a domain, we need a patch from our admin," I would have them show it to me, and after I showed them why they were wrong, I don't know that I would have that person administering emails anymore. Because that is a basic thing, and anyone who runs a spam filter should know how to do that.
I don't run a server, and I know how to do that.
That's my point.
But so, congratulations, I've given up the glass and went straight to the jug.
But that's my point, is as opposed to just whitelisting her domain, they turned off the spam and antivirus server on the State Department email servers. I mean, holy shit.
But it said I want $1 million. How am I supposed to know I was downloading malware?
I know it's politics, and I don't really do a good job of staying away from politics anymore, but I don't want to get into politics too much. But fuck, man.
It's not political to say somebody did an IT fuck up, and this is an IT fuck up. Now, the reason they did the IT fuck up, I'm thinking it's political.
I agree. I'm just sitting here. Okay, this is an example of what not to do. When your boss comes to you and says, "Well, no, we just need to turn the spam filters off," you smack them and say, "I'm sorry, sir. I thought you were delirious. You were having hysterics, sir. I didn't have any vinegar on hand, so, or smelling salts. So, you know, just smack them." You don't do that. Okay, I mean, I can see turning off the spam filter and just dealing with it for, you know, a little while you fix it. But the antivirus? I realize most people don't realize this. In the corporate world, the majority of viruses that spread through corporate networks are started still to this day via email. Drive-by downloading is a lot, and it is one of the most painful ones to deal with. But 90% of the time, it's still email. Because whereas on a home user's machine, they're not going to open just any email they get. Some will, but most people won't anymore. But in a business, people are using email as part of their job. They're emailing office documents back and forth all the time. They're emailing invoices back and forth all the time. So it's usually fairly simple to put together the social engineering scam of, hey, we got this wire transfer from your company, or here's an invoice for your latest order, to get somebody to open the damn document to run the virus to get CryptoLocker installed on the network, right? And this is how it's happening to universities and hospitals. It's because people email files all the damned time in business. So it's still the major ingress point for malware, especially because most corporations run, you know, they run a WebSense or a Palo Alto or a freaking well-configured Squid proxy, and they filter the incoming traffic so that people don't get the drive-by links. And if you're in the corporate world, a lot of times those, you know, they'll have a whitelist of sites you're allowed to visit, and usually the bad guy sites aren't on them. Or, you know, they at least try to do some kind of antivirus on the network level. I don't know. I guess I've made my point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Turning off the antivirus. The
State Department should have just said no.
Yeah. So, next one up is from usnews.com. Privacy-minded senators on Wednesday blocked an amendment that would give the FBI power to take internet records, including browser history and email metadata, without a court order, but the victory may be fleeting. Just one vote kept the measure from clearing a 60-vote procedural hurdle, and political arm-twisting may soon result in a second vote. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky switched his vote to no to allow reconsideration in the near future. That made the final tally 58-38, with four senators not voting. Critics of the proposed expansion of the FBI's ability to demand records with national security letters, or NSLs, are urging opponents to flood their senators with phone calls. There are some unexpected yes votes, such as Ted Cruz, who they hope to flip to, as some of the four senators who did not vote are viewed as tougher sells. So it's obviously a good thing. Yeah. On. ACLU is happy about this. But yeah, it looks like they're going to push for a vote to try to give the FBI expanded powers again.
I'm kind of happy that Mitch said no.
So,
I'm slightly surprised. I figured if there was a Kentucky senator saying no, it would be Paul. Now I want to look up his vote and make sure it was a no, because I can set him on fire. I know where he lives.
But yeah, it's
not that I'm planning to set in a senator on fire.
It's literally, you know, 58-48. So they
that
were one vote shy.
Fucked up.
Of giving the FBI expanded powers to just look at what you're doing online without any kind of procedure or court order.
Because who needs rights nowadays?
It's like, what the hell's wrong with getting a court fucking order?
There's nothing. It's not difficult. And the bar can be very, very, very low. Judge shopping exists.
But Madman, that's still too hard.
It isn't hard to find the most fucking racist judge and say, hi, I have some brown people I need to spy on. Or you find the most liberal SJW judge and be like, hi, he's white and has fucking privilege. And a bank account, we need to look into this. I want them to find somebody to rubber stamp the fucking form.
But that still involves paper and a rubber stamp.
I mean, smoke weed every day. I have no illusions on how hard this is to get, but it's a step. They should follow the fucking steps. It's in the rules.
At least that way there's a judge who's looking at what they're doing, right? And being like, okay, there may legitimately be something going on here. Could be nothing, but yeah, go take a look.
Yes.
As opposed to just, you know, hey, we want to see what senators are looking up, you know, I don't know, goat porn.
The answer's all of them.
Probably. So. Well, I mean, fuck, you know that's what it's for. They want to blackmail people.
Yeah. Yeah, but if it was just blackmailing senators, I could live with that. They want to blackmail people.
Because we all know government officials aren't people.
Oh, God, no. They sell their fucking souls. So. The most people-like senators are only barely people-like.
Yeah, we've seen what long-term senators look like. You're right. They're not people.
No, they're not.
So. All right. Next article up is from TechSpot. Sweden becomes the first nation to open electric highway that powers trucks using overhead lines. This is interesting. Now, I don't know. I mean, obviously, they're doing a test, and I don't know the financial viability of this, but at least from a technical standpoint, this actually seems viable.
From a technical standpoint, it's been viable for over 100 years. It's a fucking trolley car.
Okay, but it's a trolley car they can drive off the
lanes. It can turn off
lanes.
Of the trolley, yeah. It can go gas-powered and leave the trolley lane. But it's a trolley car. It's old technology. It's cool-looking, but it's a fucking trolley car.
So, while advancements in electric truck technology continue to be made, there are still limitations due to factors such as size, weight, and expense. But an invention that has been around for almost 150 years could provide a solution to these issues, so you are correct. German engineering company Siemens says that the overhead electrical wires can be used to power electric trucks for theoretically unlimited distances. The vehicle's pantograph power connections can freely connect and disconnect to the overhead wires while traveling at speeds of up to 56 miles per hour. Oh, I didn't see that part.
Here's the next issue. The electric engine is exceptionally fuel efficient. The electric power line is not exceptionally fuel efficient.
You
get something
like
32% of the energy generated is just lost by pushing it over the line. So let's say the power plant is, this is impossible, but we'll say the power plant is 100% efficient. So all of the little whatever they're using to make power gets turned into electricity. By speeding it through the power lines, you're now getting it 70% efficiency at best.
It's AC. It's not DC. It's not as bad as that you're making it out to be. But you are correct. You do use a lot for long runs, which is why they usually step the voltage up real high and then have transformer stations on the poles. Yeah, the big, you know, everybody remembers the old overhead lines. I know they're all buried these days, but the big buckets that are on the side of the lines every so often before the line runs to the house, that's a transformer that steps it down from the transmission voltages to, you know, your 120. So, yeah, they do some work to get around it, but that's why you have transformer stations and stuff. But anyways, it's a neat, I thought it was a neat idea to do this with electric vehicles to put the overhead lines in, but the 56 miles an hour kind of sucks. What is it?
Well,
has become the first. Oh, go ahead, BSV.
Is the 56 mile an hour, well, it's attached or just when it's disconnecting?
I would assume that's when it's attached, because it's the old trolley car system of having an exposed wire or a couple of exposed wires and then having brushes that are sticking up from the truck that contact the wires to get a charge.
Yeah, I'm looking at the pictures now, so...
Yeah, so I assume that the reason they can't go much faster than that is they'll melt the brushes. On a 2-kilometer stretch of the E16 highway near the city of Gavel, just north of Stockholm, two diesel hybrid vehicles made by Scantina and adapted in collaboration with Siemens will conduct the electric road trials over the next 2 years to see if it is sustainable or suitable for wider deployment. Test vehicles will operate in zero-emission mode when connected to overhead cables and switch back to diesel for operation outside of the contact lines. Siemens and the technology's open configuration would allow the trucks to use other forms of power, such as battery or natural gas. So, I think it's a neat concept. I'm not opposed to it. I'd like to see the numbers when they're done with their trials to see if this is actually viable or not. Because Madman's right, not only are you losing power by pushing it through the lines, there's the cost of that power. Who's paying for the power lines over the road? I would assume the highway department, which means there's going to be a tax somewhere to pay for that. And I imagine it's not going to be cheap. But I kind of like the idea. I don't think it's a terrible one.
It's not a terrible one, but there's a reason trolleys are out of use.
Yeah.
It's because gas is still more efficient. So, if you want to move hydrogen, I think hydrogen is as efficient or even more efficient than most gas or diesel engines. Electric lost. I hope it can eventually win. I'm cool with that. But then you also have to look at what's providing your electric energy. If it's a coal-fired power plant, then you're just moving the pollution you're thinking you're getting rid of.
Oh, I'm not saying anything about pollution. I just think it's a neat concept for the truck going for a long stretch of highway wouldn't have to pull off to refill. So that may, you know, alleviate the slow speed a little bit. But I want to see the final numbers to see if it's actually viable when they're done with their experiment. I think it's cool they're doing the experiment. That might be a better way to phrase it.
Yeah.
Well, any experimentation with new firms of tech is always good. Just because something works doesn't mean something else shouldn't be tested.
No, I'm cool with testing it. I'm just not thinking it's that awesome. And I've becoming cynical enough to look at the political motivations behind everything.
Yeah. Alright, fair enough. I thought it was an interesting experiment.
But yeah, next up, bringing the trolley car back.
Yeah, well, but it's a drivable one that you don't have to stay on the freaking wires. So,
and you know, just kind of not all trolleys were on tracks. The electric
car like that, the street trolleys.
Yeah, but
those were on tracks. I mean, this is literally 150 year old. They're just having better electric engines than the last one.
Yeah, I thought it was neat. Next up is from The Verge. Remember how Sony launched the PS3 with other OS support? Vaguely.
No.
That meant you used to follow consoles. Do you remember that?
I've always thought Sony just had their own proprietary OS. What other OS is it supporting?
I remember the Ubuntu-Hughes Linux. I never tried it, but
yeah. When the PS3 was initially launched, the original one, Sony actually advertised that you could install Linux on it.
That I do think is neat. I don't know what you use it for, but it's neat.
And of course they dropped support for it. So you can install Linux or whatever PowerPC compatible OS you could finagle under your shiny new next-gen gaming system. And then remember how a couple of years later Sony discontinued support for other OS with a system update that removed the functionality? Vaguely. I probably bitched about it on Decking, but I don't really remember.
They removed a lot of compatible options from the original.
Some people never forgot, and an on-again, off-again class action lawsuit. That's a way to describe that. It's like a relationship.
Sometimes we're saying, yeah, sometimes we can't find a lawyer. Then we find another one.
It started back in 2010. It's finally bearing fruit. Sony has agreed to a settlement with the litigants to pay $55 to anybody who can prove they owned an other OS-capable PS3, which the settlement adorably refers to as a fat PS3, as opposed to the slim model that never supported OS, and actually used the functionality. You have to prove that you actually used it.
How do you prove that?
I guess pictures of you running Linux on your PS3.
But they patched it out, so
that's the problem. If you simply knew about OtherOS and intended to use it on your fat PS3, you can get $9. If you are the lawyers, and if you are the lawyers who brought the suit, you get $2.25 million, no matter how much you care about software freedom.
Because it's all about the lawyers.
And that's really why I hate class action lawsuits.
The terms still have to be agreed upon by a California federal judge, and this is just a proposal. There's a hearing scheduled for July the 19th in Oakland. About 10 million people owned a fat PS3s, and probably a much smaller subset of those people flirted with Linux on their console. If the settlement is approved, the bonus for Sony, or the bill for Sony, will still be in the millions. Between this and Amazon money that everybody just got in their inbox, we'll soon be all rich enough to buy another cool... Okay, yeah, well, let's see.
You'll Amazon buy a money. Cheeseburger. Yeah. No one's going to be able to prove the 55. That drops you to a value meal at Burger King.
That and since when could you buy any decent electronics for 55? Well, yeah, it's biased, I don't think
they're making fun of the ebook settlement, but... Yeah. All right. Next one up. This one also is kind of cool. Actually came up with my 3D printing stuff. So, which, yeah, I got to order a whole new main board for my printer. It's something shot. I might be able to go through the multimeter and figure it out, but I've swapped several components out and the damn thing's still not working. So I don't kind of gave up and just ordered a new main board, you know? Anyways, this is from Ars Technica. I'm just going to summarize this one as opposed to reading out the full story because it goes into the science a lot. A company in China, let's see, they had the name of it. A team led by Zhaxing Zhai of the Shanghai Institute of Organic Chemistry tried to some chemical tricks to turn plastics into something useful. So, they really go into the molecular components of this. The short version of it is they have figured out how to do a chemical process that doesn't need a lot of heat, and that's what makes it different from the old methods. It only needs about 150 degrees Celsius with the chemical process, and some of the chemicals are even reusable after they've used them on the plastics, or they're reclaimable, I guess would be the better way to put it, to... break down waste plastic that is, for whatever reason, you can't normally recycle and turn it into variations of diesel fuel.
That is cool.
So they're making a Mr. Fusion, you're telling me.
No. No, most plastics are, you know, they're chemically, they come from oil in the first place, right? So
they
figured out a chemical method of getting diesel out of these things.
Of turning trash into diesel fuel.
Yes.
Which it... You know Mr. Fusion, the Back to the Future
Mr.
reference?
Oh, Mr. Fusion. I thought you said they were performing fusion. Okay.
No!
That makes much more sense now, BSP. You had me concerned.
The dropping the banana peel into the DeLorean?
It's just a plastic bottle versus a banana peel.
So, apparently there's like a waxy compound that's a leftover, but they're useful... Apparently, some of those compounds are useful in other parts, and you get diesel fuel. So, apparently, they've tuned it, so they've gotten kerosene out of it, they've gotten some other stuff out of it. But that's pretty cool because, the more I've looked into it, a lot of people go on about recycling plastics. Turns out there's a lot of different kinds of plastics, and you can't exactly mix them. They don't recycle all that well unless they're all the exact same type of plastic and pure. So, it's one of the reasons I haven't bothered with a home filament extruder to recycle my 3D prints is, you get a little bit of, I don't know, whatever, something charred up or burnt in the plastic, and you get a chunk in your filament that's going to clog your nozzle and it's game over, right? And that's just reusing the same plastic. That's not to say anything of, mixed plastics you're getting out of the trash. So,
that is cool.
It's a useful waste plastic, and maybe in a couple of years, once they figure that get the process down, they'll start collecting plastic out of trash and the floating island and make more gas, because more gas is always good.
So that this is one, really neat. Does it say what the waxy leftover can be used for? Or is it just like can be used in some stuff?
It's a component in plastic manufacturing. Where was it? Yeah, because I didn't read the whole thing. Whole process is cylindrical and doesn't stop there. The first catalyst releases some hydrogens as it pulls them off the plastic, which can be convert to any double bonds back to single bonds. The same series of reactions can play out again. Repeat this for a few hours, and only shorter chain compounds remain. Heat has to be added, but temperatures only around 150 degrees Celsius are sufficient. Because the old, I don't remember the exact method, but they did have a method for turning plastics back into diesel, but I mean, it needed like stupid amounts of heat, and it was not efficient at all.
So it wasn't cost effective to boil the plastic.
Yeah, this is actually this has the potential to actually be cost effective. Yeah, the end result is three basic compounds, very short chain compounds like butane that can be used to get the reaction started for the next plastic. Catalysts can be also separated out and reused. Longer chain wax compounds are useful inputs for the plastics making process, so they get some chemicals out of it that are useful for starting new batches of plastic. And in between, you get diesel fuel.
That is. Butane is also a fuel that we could use if they just stop at the. We've got butane and gunk.
Well, butane is for start heating the next reaction.
They can use it to heat the next reaction. It's also in cigarette lighters and some grills.
Yeah. So, this is cool.
Yeah.
Now the next story up.
I'm definitely interested in seeing how it goes.
So, I really need a theremin for, but I don't have a theremin, and I didn't think to go get a theremin sound clip before. So instead of a theremin, I'm going to play I don't know this.
No 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 sard.
You're a fucking musical instrument. You should be happy.
So this is from 9news.com.au, and I have no idea if it's real or not, but I kind of hope it is. A robot fitted with artificial intelligence is set to be sent to the scrap heap after attempting to escape its research laboratory home for a second time.
Wally? We're sending Wally to the junkyard? Or Johnny? Is it Johnny 5 or Wally?
Johnny 5.
The Promobot IR-77 first made headlines last week after escaping from the Russian laboratory. It was found about 40 minutes later in the middle of a street in the central Russian city of Perm after running out of batteries. Following two failed reprogramming attempts, the laboratory behind the artificially intelligent robot say it is still continuing to yearn for freedom. Promobot is short for promotional robot and was designed to work in customer relations. It is designed to realistically interact with humans, remembers every person it ever met, and answers their questions.
That's Oleg... why it's trying to run away. It's customer service that can't forget and can't drink.
It's just trying to find a bar, damn it.
Somebody just give it the ability to swap SD cards every once in a while, right? Oleg Kitsikursev? I don't actually know how to say that. It's got too many K's and vowels in it. That's how we know it's a Russian name. Co-founder of the research laboratory, which created Promobot IR-77, said his team may have no choice but to abandon the project. We are currently working on third-generation robots, which we plan to launch in the autumn. This is why we have given all the robots artificial intelligence, Mr. Kolsov told the Mirror. We have changed the AI system twice, so now we think we may have to dismantle it. I don't think he means the same thing AI that we mean when we say AI, but yeah, the robot is trying to escape. So he's like, well, we may have to just give up on that prototype and, you know, start over.
And apparently there are quite a few pictures of the robot in the streets.
BSP found pictures of it from RT. That is awesome. Oh, we gotta post that in the chat room. So, it gets even weirder, though, with the next article up, which is, again, I need a theremin. But somehow this isn't gonna surprise anybody. It's from Reuters.com. Under a draft plan Europe's robots are to become electronic persons.
No.
Completely defeating the point of building robots. Europe's growing army of robot workers could be classified as electronic persons and their owners liable to paying social security for them if the European Union adopts a draft plan to address the realities of the new industrial revolution. Go ahead.
Question. Since, as far as I know, we haven't developed any actual proper intelligence for robots, so by robotic worker, they mean any computer-controlled mechanical device?
Does that mean that format C colon is now murder?
It means they've realized that Social Security in all of its forms in virtually every country it's in, I have to say virtually because Chile has it right, is a pyramid scheme, and Europe has a declining population. So they're going to start taxing, they're going to apply their Social Security tax to robots in order to get businesses to pay more in Social Security tax as they're hiring fewer people.
Another question is, what happens when the first set of robot workers start filing for claims of retirement?
Yeah, we had to retire this one. It's out of date.
Does it need its Social Security number to file for its check?
Do I need a Social Security number for every iPad I own? Because that's going to be a problem.
Do they go by the controller board operating the robotic arm or the number of robotic arms?
Robots are being deployed in ever greater numbers in factories and also taking on tasks such as personal care or surgery, raising fears over unemployment, wealth inequity, and alienation. Their growing intelligence, pervasiveness, and autonomy requires rethinking everything from taxation to legal liability. A draft European Parliament motion dated May 31st suggests some robots even taking on human form. Visitors to the world's biggest travel show in March were greeted by a lifelike robot developed by Japan's Toshiba and were helped by another made in France, Aldebaran? France's Aldebaran Robotics. However, Germany's VDMA, which represents companies such as the automotive giant Siemens and robot maker KUKA, say that the proposals are too complicated and too early. Oh, shit. German robotics and automotive turnover rose 7% to 12.2 billion euros last year, and the country is keen to keep its edge in the latest industrial technology. KUKA is the target of a takeover bid by China's Midea. The draft motion called the European Commission to consider that at least the most sophisticated autonomous robots could be established as having the status of electronic persons with specific rights and obligations. They want to give the Omnix rights. Overwatch is going to happen for real.
Shouldn't they at least wait until they develop intelligence?
Or at least until we start issuing gorillas tasers? I don't want to have to go up a bunch of Omnix without a Winston.
Oh shit. It also suggested the creation of a register for smart autonomous robots, which would link each one to funds established over to cover its legal liabilities.
It doesn't have legal liabilities.
It's a machine.
You know who's responsible if a truck plows into you? The owner of the fucking truck.
I'd go with the operator at the time.
They don't have money.
Patrick Schwarzkopf, managing director of VDMA's Robotics and Automation Department, said that would create a legal framework with electronic, or that we would create a legal framework with electronic persons. That's something that could happen in 50 years, but not in 10 years. We think it'd be very bureaucratic and would stunt the development of robotics, he told reporters at the Automatica Robotics Trade Fair in Munich, while acknowledging that a legal framework for self-driving cars would be needed soon. The report added that robotics and artificial intelligence may result in a large part of the work now done by humans being taken over by robots, raising concerns about the future of employment and viability of social security systems. The draft motion drawn up by European Parliament Committee on Legal Affairs also said organizations would have to declare savings they've made in Social Security contributions by using robots instead of people for tax purposes. And so I think you're spot on there, Madman, with your assertion that this is a tax collection bill. This has nothing to do with the...
I knew it was whenever you said there was a bill. You could have stopped there and I could have explained exactly why they were doing it. Because liability, it's very easy, and it's already been estranged in English common law for close to 1,000 years. The way you determine liability is who got hurt. Was it on someone's property or by someone's property? Do we know whose property it is? Is it foreseeable that whatever the property did could have hurt somebody? Oh, so-and-so is liable. So if I have a robot diesel truck and I'm West Freight and my robot diesel truck plows over a car and injures 6 people, the robot truck isn't liable because it's a fucking robot. West Freight is liable. West Freight pays. It's already set up. You don't need to pass a law. It already exists.
Well, Madman, yay! It's even more simple than that. So the clue to it was in the last line there, that they want to know how much you're saving on your Social Security taxes by replacing people with robots, which ultimately means what they want is, oh, well, we think your business should have supported 1,000 employees, but you have automation in there, which means it runs on 30. We expect you to pay for the 1,000 employees in Social Security that you should have, because otherwise you can't tell to the business how many employees would you have to replace that automation, because your machines you can run day and night, and you know, one person operating an automated line might replace 100 workers. That's not odd. That's not even outlandish. You look at modern automotive industry, but modern automotive industry has been automated for years. So where do you start with this? Do you go back to what would it take the Amish to build this? Okay, that's how many employees you should have. Seriously, what do you count as automation? Does using a power tool count as automation?
You have to build it with your bare hands.
I mean, I go back to the Omnic joke because there was actually a point to that, believe it or not. In the game, Omnics are true AI, you know, singularity passing robots, right? They're, you know, artificial people in every sense. The robot arm that assembles car doors down at the Ford assembly plant is not intelligent. It's a machine performing a process. Yes, it's a robot, but it's not a person. You know, the touch screen that's going to replace your waiter at a restaurant is not a person. It's an iPad. Well, probably Android, but I mean,
the iPad that's replacing your therapist isn't a person. It's a flashy light that makes you feel good.
Yes!
All I know is this is another reason Britain should leave the EU, because they're all crazy.
Well, we'll find that out tomorrow morning, won't we? So it's just like, this is obviously just a means of, you know, squeezing more money out of business owners. And I guess if your politics swing that way, you might think it's a good thing, but I'm...
As of 10:07, leaving is winning again.
So here's the, you know, I mean, you know, I guess if you're going to swing that way politically, which Europe obviously is, you know, if you're going to do things like universal basic income and just assume that you're going to have 70% of your population unemployable because of robotics and automation, I guess you're going to have to do something, but it seems like such a weird way to do it.
The bad thing is, only reason 70% of their population may become unemployable is they're bringing in people that don't have the IQ or the education to work in the new economy.
But it's not even that. It's just they're going on these assumptions that you know, we're just going to have these large swaths of unemployable people, and we probably will, but not for the reasons they think we will. They think we will because, you know, people are greedy and businesses don't want to hire people and blah, 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 blah. Whereas the real reason is you're not going to have any reason to hire these people, whether they're immigrants or not, because our education system's a joke. It's full of people who are more interested in re-implementing segregation than, you know, actually learning something or being exposed to ideas. Most people want to sit around, collect their check, and watch TV and scratch their nuts all day as opposed to actually trying to do something. Fuck, I don't know. Here, I'm just trying to keep politics out of it. Let's do Dojo. It's sad. You know what I mean? It's just fucking sad.
But think of the old folks' retirement home for robots. Will the Commodore 64 finally network with an Acer?
I've done that, though. I've made a Commodore 64 useful, okay? Not particularly useful, but useful.
Yes, but I don't want to be the worker in a old folks home for welder robots. Sounds like a good way of getting burned. Yo!
Hadouken! Alright, I have got a couple of things up for Digital Dojo tonight. First one up is an article from InfoSecZone.net, which is a tutorial on doing blind SQL injection. So I guess I should explain. BSV, Madman, are you both familiar with regular SQL injection?
Is that when you're keying in a bunch of characters into, I don't know, a login window to see what happens?
Okay, kind of. So SQL injection, I guess to even go back more basic than that, SQL or SQL stands for Structured Query Language. It is the common language you use when you're trying to pull information or store information in a database.
Okay.
So you're with me there. SQL injection is where you write SQL code into usually a web page that for whatever reason is not filtering out that SQL code, and it lets you manipulate the query that the website is doing on the back end. And, you know, for a login box, you would do the classic close the parenthesis off so that it closes the string on the back end, because you assume, you kind of make an assumption that, okay, what's the thing doing when it queries the database? It's going to say, does my username equal, a known user? So it's going to say, okay, so where, I guess it would be something along the lines of select password from users where user equals then whatever you punched in for the username, right? So, and then it was going to compare that password to the password you punched in. That is a horrible way. No website should actually use that code that I just came up with, because you're not hashing the password. There's all kinds of things like that. But it's an easy example. So you then go in there and you punch in the username you want, you close quote, and then you say, or 1 equals 1. So it's going to say, does my password match or does 1 equal 1?
Well, 1 equals 1. Password doesn't match, but 1 does equal 1. This must be the correct answer.
Yeah, so you get let into the website without knowing the correct password. That's an extremely basic example of SQL injection. The more common one is where you find a form or a login box, and you're able to induce it to spit errors out on the page, and then use those errors to, maybe you change it to just dump everything that's in the database. So whenever you hear about password dumps out of forums, it's usually what's happened is somebody's found a form or a web page that they can manipulate the SQL and just dump the whole database out and just save the output. And now you've got your password dump. So you just say select star from passwords, depending on the database on the back end. And sometimes it can be some work to figure out exactly what you're doing because you're injecting code into a place it doesn't really go. Blind SQL injection is doing the same thing, except on a website that's coded such that you don't get the error messages back. So you don't exactly know what you're doing. That's the easiest way to describe it. So Let's see. They describe it on this page. Blind SQL injection is a type of SQL injection that asks the database true or false questions and determines the answer based on the application response. The attack is often used when the web application is configured to show generic error messages, but has not mitigated the code that is vulnerable to SQL injection. So in some cases, normal SQL injection using normal SQL injection is not work or will not work. Blind SQL injection is another method which may help you. The important part for blind SQL injection is the difference between the valid and invalid query result. You have to inject a statement to make a valid query or invalid and observe the response. So, you know, let's go back to my password example. Well, on a page that blind SQL, you don't need to use the blind SQL injection. If you go messing with it, you might get an error back, you know, that says PHP error, you know, query not structured right, and then you see that, oh, it stripped my quotes out, so you need to like punch in the Unicode quote or HTML symbol for it and see if it processes it correctly, or maybe some, you know, maybe you can inject JavaScript somewhere to not, you know, filter your input, you know, stuff like that, right? No, nope, they weren't Mad Men, and Mad Men's back. So I don't know how much of that explanation you just heard, Mad Men.
But, the blind SQL injection does true-false inquiries, but doesn't actually get the errors. It's going by what the database is responding as.
Right. So pretty go much. Back to the password example. You, it might come back and tell you what the, you know, like, there's a problem with your query, or it wasn't structured right, or if you do the dump, you'll get the result of the dump back on the page. Whereas some applications are going to be coded in such a way or configured in such a way that you're going to get a generic error message back, or even if you don't, it may not dump the output from the SQL query on the page anywhere useful, right? So you might be able to get it to induce the database to dump out all the passwords, but the application's not going to show it to you anywhere. It's just going to go into the memory for that query and do nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So blind SQL injection is where you insert things like weights to see if there's SQL injection there or not. Because I'm listing some very basic examples. If there's SQL injection, you can usually do all kinds of things to a database. Like if it's not going to display the output on the web page, so you can just copy it off, you can usually induce the database system to write the output to a file and have it put that file someplace that's accessible to the web server, so you can just save it out that way if you're trying to do like a password dump. If there is SQL injection, you might be able to put crap in their database. You might be able to save things. So, you know, testing it with blind SQL injection or understanding the concept of how to do blind SQL injection is quite useful, because if you can induce a sleep for 30 and then the website takes 30 seconds to come back, well, even though you're not getting an error message, you know that you can punch commands into their database, and then it's just, you know, how creative are you? So, you know, or can you screw with their web page? You know, that's how people do defacements, that kind of thing. So that's kind of a starting point. But this is a nice guide on it. It explains doing the weights, doing the true falses, kind of testing to just, do you get an error back or not? So if you can do SQL injection and you may not get an error back, but it accepts what you were doing to it, then, you know, hey, that you might be able to do things to the database through there. So anyways, it's got a nice guide. It's got some examples of how to do it, and, you know, some examples of how to get around things like some of the input filtering, you know, doing character conversions and things like that. So, yeah, it's a nice guide. Worth reading if you do web
security. After we check out the web page that we've created ourselves, because we're not actually doing this, you know, in anyone else's server, figure out how to prevent these attacks from happening on your.
Yeah, once you figure out that they're there, that's when you go back and go, "Oh, I'm not doing my input sanitization. I'm not doing structured queries. I'm not doing." You know, those are the two big ones for SQL injection. Or maybe you can't fix the web application because it's, you know, maybe you didn't write it, or the person who wrote it has left, or whatever. So it's like, oh, well, I need a WAF, or I need to change how my database is configured, or I don't know. Million and one ways, depending on whatever the problem is, right? So, anyways, next, the last one up is from TrustedSec, and is an introduction to GPU password cracking. And they used the LinkedIn password dump as a example. So it's got an interesting write up. using CUDA Hashcrat and the LinkedIn password dump to crack all the hashes on your graphics card. And it's got command line and all this example stuff here. So this is a nice guide if you've never done the GPU password cracking. So I know I used to talk about rainbow tables a lot, and you really don't see people handling rainbow tables like they used to, because for the most part, the people who are doing large-scale password cracking are doing it with GPUs. They basically take a Bitcoin mining rig, and instead of mining Bitcoins with it, they mine passwords. They do the SQL injection dump I was talking about a minute ago. They dump all the passwords out of a database. They then throw something like CUDA Hashcrack at it, and or CUDA Hashcat, I should say, at it with a, you know, with what would be your average Bitcoin mining rig or GPU mining rig. Well, I guess what used to be your average, now everybody does Bitcoins with the little ASICs, but the four graphics cards on a one system kind of thing, right? And crack the passwords in a couple hours as opposed to using rainbow tables, which doesn't require you to keep several, you know, terabytes of rainbow tables around, which is always kind of nice. So, anyways, that's always handy. I don't know. Oh, BSV muted. Any thoughts, Madman?
No.
So, in your dojo tonight, I've got a guide on getting, you know, how to do SQL injection and a guide on what to do with it. So, you know, the CUDA password hacking. So,
although, now your Bitcoin miner might have multiple uses.
Exactly. And then finally, just because it was useful earlier tonight in some conversations I was having, if you're not aware of it, CPU-Z is nice because it tells you what all the hell you've got in your system, mainboard and processor-wise. So if you've forgotten, which was my problem, is I couldn't remember how many RAM slots I had free, or if you're doing like BSV and trying to remember what processor socket you've got, it's nice. You just run it and it tells you what you got. So if you weren't aware of it, I assume most people who do this stuff on a regular basis are aware of it, but in case you're not, there's CPU-Z.
So. I build a computer, and then it runs until it catches fire. So eventually I'm going to forget what components are in it.
Yeah, it's just useful to know about if you didn't know about it, I would be surprised, but you know, hey, for everybody who thinks you know it's common knowledge, it's usually one person out of 100's first time hearing it, so hey, if you're that one person learning something about that program, congratulations. So that's all I got. Madman, any thoughts before I play the Pac-Man music?
We need to get him a power pellet before he meets those damn ghosts.
BSV, do you have any thoughts before I hit the Pac-Man music?
Drinking an entire 2 liters of alcohol in an hour really makes you need to use the bathroom.
Fair Ooh. Enough.
In the electronics retirement homes, because they're really going to have trouble defining a robot, you think all the old PCs are just going to be showing porn at varying resolutions to themselves?
Yeah, well, yeah, they'll be showing porn to the machines that weren't capable of downloading porn. Noob, any thoughts before we close out the show?
Smoke weed every day.
All right, then. That's it. I'm done listening to the stream, always working on it. One of these days I'm going to get around to working on the website. I've got to kind of make up my mind about that. And, I don't know, last week, did we declare Madman is running the station now instead of me? I don't remember.
I think for at least legal liability purposes, I may have been put in charge of the station. I'm the official scapegoats.
That is, we got to put title sections on the webpage.
Wait,
Madman, official
the,
scapegoat.
Depending we on need, if the EU, or EU thing pass, if we move the servers themselves to the EU, we can just blame the servers.
People.
Yeah, and they're unemployed electronic persons. I'm not going to give the fucker
we can
a
make,
job.
If they're unemployed, that means we can make money by
unemployment
filing
benefits.
Anyway.
I think the unemployment check's going to be higher than the electric bill needed to sustain them.
Are we talking about turning the Galaxy 15 into an EU-subsidized radio station? That would be kind of awesome.
I mean, we have to look at the retirement age of machines, and we can't go by people years, because they're going to be replaced at the rate machines are replaced by, right? So, the box-running machine is how many generations past?
So, well, now this raises an interesting question. So when you buy the latest and greatest computer, it's, you know, 6 months old, right? So if that's the age it is in EU, it's considered a person, and it's only a couple of months old. If somebody looks up, like, I don't know, 4chan on there, does that make them a pedophile?
What depends.
Only if the webcam is on.
Well, it depends if it's considered the age of when it's a person, or the age of when it's actually a working member of society.
Leave it to Europe to make this shit confusing. That's all I've got. I'm going to play the Pac-Man sound now.